comes the sun, little darling.
So hey everybody, welcome to Voices from the Frontlines. This is, to me, a very exciting show. It takes a lot of work. We have a producer, Crystal McMillan. We have a terrific team with Tanya Bernard, who does our website, www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. We really want you to go on there. We have Julian Lamb, who's a terrific sound engineer and technician who makes sure the show is up on the website so you can download it very quickly. By Thursday morning, you can get it at www.voicesfromthefrontlines. We have a Twitter account, which is at Eric Mann Speaks, and I am going to read a few tweets about the Counterpunch article. So I want to start by introducing Jeffrey St. Clair, who's the editor of Counterpunch, who's been a longtime movement activist, and who's now moved to both, he does his own writing, he does books, and of course he's the editor of a very important online magazine. Jeffrey, nice to have you on the show.
Glad to be here, Eric.
So let me just do a little preface about the article that I did and some of the response, and then I want to get you, of course, much more importantly, to talk about Counterpunch in general. I was very fortunate. I've been working with Jeffrey now on several articles, and we had an article last Wednesday in Counterpunch called Palestine Will Win, Solidarity from a Self-Respecting Jew. And the concept was that the Israeli government has accused non-Jews who criticize its policies in Palestine as anti-Semitic, but has also gone after Jews who have opposed the ethnocide against the people of Palestine as self-hating Jews, with the argument that people like myself, the reason we side with the Palestinian people is because we're ashamed of being Jewish and all that kind of stuff. So it's on the surface pretty bizarre, except that Israel has a tremendous amount of power and control over the international dialogue. But that is starting to erode, and there really, I do believe, is a tipping point over this phenomenal brutality in Gaza that will not stop, and the recent occupation again of 1,000 more acres to seize more land in the West Bank. So when we had the show, when we did the article on Counterpunch, we asked people, and Jeffrey was nice enough at the end of my article, it said if he could be reached at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And, you know, sometimes we get a few. On the LeBron James article, we got 15 terrific responses. On this one, it's been sort of off the hook, and we've gotten at least 50 emails, Twitter, Facebook. So I just want to read a couple of responses to the article, which talks to the power of Counterpunch and the relationship we're trying to figure out between Counterpunch and Voices from the Frontlines. That's a long introduction, but let me read a couple of things. So one is by an old friend of mine named Gene Bruskin, who's been in the labor movement on the left. He's done U.S. labor against the war. He's a tremendous organizer. So he wrote me to say, he did his own, saying Reflections of Another Self-Respecting Jew by Gene Bruskin. It says, let me start by saying thank you to Eric Mann for this groundbreaking article on Counterpunch. As a working-class Jew from South Philadelphia, I've been outraged for years that the Israeli government dared to speak and act so brutally in my name. So much of what is in my bones is a lifetime social activist, radical, movement builder, anti-racist, internationalist, for me, connected to my Jewishness. My grandparents in the Pale in Russia fled after their parents were thrown down a well by the Cossacks. My wife's family suffered severely in the Holocaust. Even with my highly secular Jewish upbringing, I learned deep pride in being part of a legacy of people who fought repeatedly against oppression and often stood with those who were oppressed. My father was a young communist activist in Philadelphia in the 30s, as were other members of my family. When my parents moved us out of the city, my father refused to promise neighbors not to sell to blacks. And then he goes into, I found Jews playing key roles more recently as I've resumed my interest in musical theater. I've been reminded of the vital role that Jews played in the U.S. progressive culture in the 20th century. So that's my friend Gene Ruskin. And then I have another friend in Germany. I don't know if you know him, by the way, Jeffrey. His name is Victor Wexler Grossman. Do you know about him? He defected in 1953 from the U.S. Army. He went to the Soviet Union where he was interrogated. And after they decided he wasn't a CIA agent, he was sent to East Berlin, where he lived his whole life, and he's still in East Berlin. So he wrote me, he's about 90, I think, Dear Eric, a fine article, and I want to just read this out because it shows the complexity of dialectics of what he's thinking about. I hope it's also convincing to some of those now gradually becoming aware of the true situation. American Jews are clearly a main key to the whole situation in the Israel-Palestine area, and their move away support from AIPAC, the American-Israeli, it's not the Political Action Committee, but it's something similar, and similar organizations is clearly crucial. Your very good coining or promotion of the term self-respecting Jews to counteract that self-hating Jews blasphemy should help. Good luck. But now I want to read the last paragraph and finally get to you, Jeffrey. Here in Germany, we face similar problems with the added complication that the necessary opposition to Netanyahu, A. Lieberman, etc., must be especially careful to distinguish itself from Nazi anti-Semites, some of them thugs, others more subtle, who take advantage of the widespread rejection of Israeli massacres by ordinary Germans. But it must also distinguish itself very clearly from those who are trying to turn opposition to anti-Semitism into Muslimophobia, which is a key issue here increasingly and dangerously used by the rightists in Germany and many other European countries, and the U.S., of course, is shockingly similar to the old fascist anti-Semitism and serves basically the same purpose. Thanks again for your clarifying article. So, you see what you've wrought, Jeffrey?
Sorry about that.
It's been pretty cool. Tell me, Coburn, how did you initiate Counterpunch? What was your thinking about it? And how do you see it today?
Well, actually, Counterpunch started mainly as a... I get a little feedback here.
Sure.
It was a kind of DC-oriented publication. And so we were looking... In fact, the subtitle was... Stories of Power and Evil in Washington. So we did a lot of stories in the early 90s as the Clinton team was assuming the powers of the regime. The influence of lobbyists on the Clinton crowd, political action committees, which were then becoming a sort of dominant player in D.C. And for the first maybe 3 or 4 years of Counterpunch, that was our main focus. But gradually, we broadened our wing and began doing more international reporting, more movement reporting. And then, I guess at the end of Clinton time, we finally bit the bullet and went online. And that really changed the ballgame for us because we had a subscriber base with our print edition of maybe 5,000.
Right.
Which seemed pretty good. I mean, it wasn't I.F. Stone. I mean, he was something else, man. He had 100,000 subscribers to I.F. Stone's Weekly back in the mid-60s. But we were feeling pretty good at 5,000. But within a few weeks of being online, our reach had increased tenfold.
Wow.
And so that was something that shocked us both. And the other thing was that it was a global reach. We were getting, we had readers in Iceland. We had readers in the West Bank. We had readers in South Africa. We had readers, in India. Lots of readers in India. Lots of readers in South Korea, Japan, even China, even Iran. So we really had to rethink the kind of journalism that we were doing. In the first place, up until that point, Alex and I had been doing, I would say, 90% of the writing.
Right.
And we couldn't keep that up with the demands of online journalism, so we had to recruit new writers. It wasn't hard, because there are a hell of a lot of writers out there who are very good, who are looking for a venue. And well, since then, it's grown and grown. I mean, we now get, upwards of, sometimes we'll get 1 million readers in a day, which is just out of this world. I mean, we would have never have thought of, dreamed of that, back in 93 and 94 when Counterpunch was just incubating.
Let's take a minute on that. Tanya Bernard and both Alan Minsky, program director at KPFK, there are obviously these metric measurements, and we were discussing Counterpunch, and they went on, whatever, how you check those things. And they were very impressive metrics. So tell us a little bit more about what does it mean to have 1 million readers? What level of response do you get? How are you measuring the impact of the work?
Well, now those are kind of different questions.
That's right, isn't it? Right.
I measure the reach. I mean, I can just tell it with my emails, and I deploy Star Wars filters. You know, every kind of filter I can have to sort of shoot down emails. And I still get. It's like genocide every morning, Eric. But I still get like 2,000, 2,500 emails in my box every day.
Wow.
So that tells you we've got a lot of readers, a lot of writers. And they're coming from everywhere. And we can study the metrics. Wars, obviously, are very good for us. So, I mean, it's sad to say so, but every time Israel decides to whack Gaza or invade Lebanon, our readership goes up. And, you know, they do that frequently now. It seems to be going all the time. And then we had, you know, the U.S. posturing in Ukraine.
Right.
Which we, you know, had on the ground reporting from, you know, Ukrainians. And we had it immediately. And so that was very useful information for people. And it was information that people were starving for around the world. And then we had the trifecta of, you know, the murder of Michael Brown while walking while black in St. Louis County. And so that, like, sent our numbers, through the roof. And so we could not have done that as a print publication. We were only coming out at the beginning once every 2 weeks. And now, you have to have something fresh up, and we have the ability to do that. You know, we're running, 10 to 15 stories every day, and then we produce a weekend edition, which, you know, has 40 stories, and it's a lot to do. It's a lot. There are only two of us, you know, at the editorial helm here, so it's
no, you shouldn't tell people that. You mean you have 2,000 staff, but
yes.
That's what you meant, of course, when you said two.
Right, all of those former New York Times editors, they've all come to work for us.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to thank you for, under those circumstances, you're very good at answering my emails. I'm pretty impressed, and I really do appreciate how quickly you've been able to get these stories up, which is pretty exciting. And of course, I've actually been reading Counterpunch more, you know, so I go on pretty regularly. I tend to write on the weekends, and I've been reading the weekend editions. Pretty cool, you know, as you said, it's very rich. So let me ask you another question, which is now the question of impact. What I'm interested in doing, of course, is reaching people who are really doing things. You know, in other words, we're trying to find and build a growing number of people around the country who are truly on the front lines of doing work. And that work could be intellectual work. It could be writers, certainly cultural workers, organizers. I used to, you know, write for several liberal magazines, and a lot of people would come up to me and say, wow, you know, I love your work. I love your articles. I said, great. What do you do? And they say, do? I say, yeah, what do you do? Oh, I don't do anything. I just read your articles. And, you know, so the question is, how do we get this in the hands of black people? How do we get in the hands of Latinos? How do we get in the hands of young people? And I do think that this online work is pretty exciting. So what's the kind of response? Oh, and also you have, of course, two of my closest friends and colleagues, which is Vijay Prashad and Robin D.G. Kelly, are pretty damn good writers you have for Counterpunch, and they encouraged me to write. So let's talk about Vijay's work for a minute, because you said about Indian, you know, audiences. What's been the response to some of Vijay's work? What's been some of the responses to Robin's work?
Yeah, well, I mean, in India, I think we have two of the best Indian writers. One is, of course, Vijay, and the other is P. Sainath, who's just one of the greatest reporters in the world. He's done a lot of reporting he is the guy to go to on reporting on rural India, on the impact of international trade policy on the Indian poor, particularly Indian farmers. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about the rates of Indian farmer suicide.
It's unbelievable.
Which is just staggering, hundreds of thousands over the course of the past 15 years, and all of that reporting has been done by Sainath.
And say, spell his name, and I'm sorry, I should know.
He goes by the first initial P, and then his last name, which is Sainath, S-A-I-N-A-T-H.
Got it.
And he's won many awards, the equivalent of the Asian press's equivalent of what would be our Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
Which he's won multiple times.
So I'll Google him tonight, and of course I'll do a search on Counterpunch.
Right. And a great book. I mean, his book is, I think, one of the most important books of the last 20 or 30 years, Everybody Loves a Good Drought, which is about how the elites, this is, you know, before, you know, we all know disaster capitalism.
Right.
This came out before all of that, and it showed how the global elites will leave no tragedy unexploited in the name of humanitarian intervention. You know, only in the case of India, it wasn't, you know, intervening with cruise missiles, but with sort of do-gooder types like USAID and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So he's brilliant. And Vijay is like, you know, one of the great sort of global reporters, because, you know, one minute he's in India, the next he's in Pakistan. For the past maybe 6 to 8 months, I think, he had been in Lebanon, where he was, you know, reporting on the breakdown of Libya after the liberation, on Palestinian refugee camps inside Lebanon, on the Syrian civil war, and on the rise of ISIS. And now he's back in the U.S., back at, I think he's at Trinity College.
That's right.
And he had a fantastic story for us yesterday on the really obnoxious behavior by the current chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley. So, I mean, BJ is one of a kind. He's a historian who has that meticulous sense of deep research, and on the other hand, he is a fantastic polemicist who can really boil things down, who, as my, you know, old colleague Alexander Coburn used to say, you know, his hate is pure, and it really comes out. He can write white-hot prose, and it goes right to the gut, you know?
Well, the interesting thing, and also, I just want to say another minute on our favorite books, but The Darker Nations, I read that book. I'm doing a lot of work on the what I call the two decades, the 60s, from 1955 to 1975, from Bandung and Emmett Till and Montgomery to the defeat of the United States in Vietnam. And I'm reworking a lot of thoughts about revolutionary strategy today. And I am a historian myself, so I read a ton of history. And the thing that Robin and Vijay have in common is, where in the hell do they learn all these facts? I mean, the attention to specificity, in as well as the broadness of the argument, is the scholarly nature of the stuff is so densely packed and so brilliantly argued, you know, and so popularly done. It's a real art form. And I, you know, I'm very hammer and hoe with Robin. So many of Robin's books are pretty amazing. So tell me a little bit about Robin.
Robin's fantastic. I mean, we have a lot, you know, a lot of our older readers are sort of tending to bemoan the fact that, oh, where are we going to replace the Chomskys and the Howard Zenns? Well, there are some brilliant new writers coming up, and BJ and Robin are two of them. One of the things that I mean, and both of them are polymaths, you know, they can write about almost anything. And, I mean, I'm a huge, you know, jazz fan, and, you know, Robin's book on Monk.
That's right.
It's just one of the most brilliant biographies that I've read in many years. And it's a biography that's, you know, he writes as, you know, as knowledgeably, you know, about Monk's, curious style of piano playing as he does about the, issues of racial, economic, and social justice in New York and, during the age of bebop in the 50s and 60s. And it's, he's just, an incredibly talented writer.
And the Monk book.
And activist. I mean, he's got the whole toolkit going for him.
No, and the thing about Robin is he doesn't work hard enough, you know? I mean, he sleeps at least 2 hours a night, and I've been telling him, man, you got to cut down on that sleep, you know? I mean, I don't know how prolific he can be. In the Monk book, it's really amazing because this is fun talking about writers, right? That he'll say, well, Monk was doing this thing in B-flat minor, but then he used to be in the group that was run by Benny Golson, but then he split with this guy. And it's like a left, instead of a left archaeological digs, it's all the different jazz relationships. Then you have to understand what's going on historically at the time. So let me tell you about Black liberation, but you have to understand this in an international context. So his mind, like a jazz musician, does go all over the place in the very best sense of improvisation. And it shows you the kind of complexity of a mind. So let's talk about you as a writer.
And you got to keep up.
I do.
I mean, he's not writing down, you know, he's not writing down to his readership, you know. You got to bring your game. You got to bring your A game as a reader to, and it's fun because it pays off. There are many, many rewards for reading this stuff. But, you know, you're not skimming it. You can't go in and skim it.
Well, you know, just staying on this, I can see we're going to have you on again soon, Jeffrey. We have a lot, but I've been having a lot of difficulty in talking to young people at reading, and really to grasp reading as, can't explain it as a, not just an art form, but to understand that, like, I read Black Reconstruction America, you know, once a year at least. But I can only get through about a chapter because Du Bois, I read it sentence by sentence, word by word. You know, everything is so brilliantly constructed. What's exciting about Counterpunch as we're talking is, you know, during there were the new masses. There were obviously, you know, during the 60s, there was no real national magazine that I can think of. You know, I would write articles for New Left Notes and get thousands of people to read it, though, you know, and the people would read articles. So one of the things I wanted to say is that I'm very appreciative about you running longer pieces and allowing an online magazine to sort of allow itself to also be a literary magazine in some way and not restricting itself to this perception that online means short, online means people with low attention spans. Have you been grappling with that one?
Well, we have. Now, you know, I have to confess that Alex and I, one of the reasons we hit it off, I mean, there are many, but we were both English literature majors. He went to Oxford, I went to American University in D.C.,
right.
And so, I mean, we like to write, we like to read, and, you know, when we were doing the print issue, we were really bound. I mean, we couldn't, it was hard to stuff stories in there that were longer than, you know, maybe 2,000 words.
Right.
Now, you know, the web freed us to a certain degree from the shackles of those shorter pieces. It allowed us to sort of stretch, and other writers, of course, to stretch out and, you know, do historical surveys, sort of biographical profiles, or some deep analysis. Now, the problem was, were the readers online interested in reading that? Could they, you know, were they going to stick with a 5,000 word story? And I think a lot of, now I don't know how many were turning off, but a lot of people are saying, man, this is what we've longed for. Some, this is real red meat stuff that, you know, we can sink our teeth in, and really, you know, chew over. Now, on the other hand, we also live in the generation of the tweet. And we used to call Counterpunch, Alex came up with the phrase, we're a Twitter-free zone, which we were for a while. We're no longer that. we've hit the bullet. But it is that sort of, there is an instantaneous kind of ephemeral quality, I think, to the web that finds its expression in the Twitter feeds, which seems to run. You know, I mean, how could people possibly read all the stories they're tweeting about? Because they're tweeting about 15 or 20 in a day. So I think that's a challenge that that online journalists and editors and readers, you know, are faced with.
Real quick, because you have 2 minutes, I just want to read you a couple of tweets at Eric Mann Speak. So this is about Counterpunch. National Counterpunch, good read. I, too, grew up in a Jewish home fighting for civil rights for all. Still am. Zero Badillion. Dean Taylor at Counterpunch, an excellent affecting article it is, too. Thank you for a lifetime of acting on conscience. So, A. Bird, 98% of American Jews are pro-Israel. Jewish anti-Semitism was even in Germany and Britain in 1939. The point being is that I do also believe in tweets and the 140-character stuff. And I got to say goodbye to you. What's your last sentence, my brother? And we'll talk again. What's your last profound thought?
The last, hey, take it from the web and put it to work on the streets.
Hey, that was pretty good.
That's our challenge.
You should coin that. Okay, we got a deal. The voice you've been hearing is Jeffrey St. Clair, the editor of Counterpunch magazine. He and the late Alex Coburn initiated this terrific magazine. It's now, of course, online. Go on Counterpunch. This is Eric Mann saying thanks a whole lot for being with us, listening to us on Voices from the Frontlines. You can reach me at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. I'd love to read some tweets tonight, folks, at Eric Mann Speaks. I want to thank everybody for their support of the show. We'll see you next Tuesday. Take good care of yourself.